Hello, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast made up of un-people, undoing un-things, un-together. Sorry, that was unforgivable. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm unattainably yet still here.
And we are back discussing the Doctor Who stories of Season 9. We've got two more to go today. So we're off on a trip into space next. We're heading to the planet of Solos, home to the mutants.
Mr. Carey.
Yes. Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble.
In fact, this is my story and so is the next one.
Lucky
so both
you.
Of you, you can both go home, really. This is, it'll be the Nathan show this week.
I am home.
Oh, okay, yeah.
This
sorry.
Is my home.
He lives in the podcast. You know that.
Although that's oddly topical for this story. People saying, you people should go home. And the people responding, we are home. You came here.
This is so, so obviously about colonialism and
especially apartheid.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, and there's all sorts of elements of other things as well. Colony in space was set 500 years in the future, and people are just sort of mining and starting colonies and that kind of thing. And this is 1,000 years in the future, and so this is the middle of a sort of trilogy of future stories that will culminate in sort of Frontier in Space next year. And this is a sort of Earth future history that's sort of a bit standard, like the New Adventures picks up on it as if it's like an actual thing.
Yeah, the Doctor describes it as the end of Earth's empire.
Yeah, he compares it to,
Twilight Years.
The history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon, like he mentions Gibbon.
And in the new series we get reference to the fourth human empire by the year 500,000. So, obviously it's going to rise and fall a few more times.
Well, Russell pushes all of the sort of future stuff out into the far future, kind of, so as not to collide with this. And so what's happened here is, you know, the Earth has colonised this planet, has strip-mined it for sort of rocket fuel, essentially, thesium, and is about to grant it independence. And so it is really topical stuff about the sort of British Empire, and it's fairly negative and anxious about the whole idea of colonialism, I think.
It's really blatantly so about exploitation and about mineral rights and the fact that, you know, these colonial citizens or colonised citizens had no rights over their own land.
Yeah, so very early on you see this sort of visualised in the fact that we're on a sky base, which is a big satellite.
Sky base. The Valiant sky base.
And we sort of teleport down to Earth, you know, and there's a humans and a overlords and a Silurians thing, you know, like separate drinking fountains for black people and white people in the United States. And the Doctor, when he sees it, actually uses the word segregation. And so that is...
And quite disgustedly as well, you know, it's not scientific detachment. He says, oh, segregation.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's on the eve of independence. And we're going to grant independence not because we've realised we've been doing the wrong things.
Yeah, not humanitarian
these
reasons.
People.
Yeah.
We've run out of money. The Earth is exhausted. It's environmentally destroyed. There's just no money to support Solos. There's no thesium left. And so we're going to go.
Yeah.
And in order to announce independence, we get the lovely Jeffrey Palmer arrives on Sky Base.
Doctor Who's very own Sean Bean, because you know what happens when he turns up.
Oh, he'll get killed.
Yeah.
Yeah, like quite early on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, he really only lasts less than an episode.
Mm.
So he gives this very self-serving speech where he says, you know, that humans and Solonians have been working together and now we've decided that Solonians have been developed enough that they can now rule themselves. And so there's all this sort of moral justification, but he does give the real kind of tawdry justification to the Marshal. Now, the Marshal is...
Paul Whitson-Jones.
Who we have seen previously in...
The Smugglers.
Yeah. And so he's sort of terribly fat and overacting and all of that sort of thing.
Nathan is actually controlling this podcast because he just gestures at me for names now. That's my only contribution. I'm Councillor Troy. I'm Lieutenant Tawny Madison in Galaxy Quest.
That's it. That's Scorny Weaver reading off the computer.
You know, I'm quite happy being Nichelle Nichols or Sigourney Weaver or even Marina Sirtis, who's really just a dark-haired Bonnie Langford.
Yes, you could do worse, couldn't you?
Yeah.
In fact, what's going to happen is, and it's a sort of strange twist, the Marshal doesn't want colonialism to end because he's got a whole planet that he can run.
Yeah,
exactly. And so he has Jeffrey Palmer executed and he declares martial law And, like, I don't know that much about the sort of politics of the time, but is this a Rhodesia thing?
Yes, it is. It's the most obvious signifier is the divided teleports for overlords and locals. It's not overly complex in its, you know, political symbolism, but it doesn't have to be. It was such a topical thing.
Yeah, so Rhodesia, at the time, all the way through the 60s, the British government had discussed giving independence to South Rhodesia. Yep. But the condition was that it would have to be majority rule so that everyone would have one vote. Mm. And the white minority government objected to this.
Yeah, and so that was that was the caveat. That was the only thing that they were going to get.
Yeah, that's right. So they unilaterally declared independence, you know what I mean, so that the decolonisation didn't happen. And so it's very much around about that sort of thing. So there are all sorts of issues of race and empire and stuff all the way sort of underneath this.
Yeah. And I do find those issues very effective because straight away we are introduced to the concept of we have this young, again, freedom fighter slash terrorist.
Slash terrorist.
In the form of Kai, played by Garrick Hagen, who, during the speech to give independence, gets up and start objecting. And on the very surface level, you can say, shut up, you're about to get what you want. And it's actually, no, why should this culture get what they want on the terms of their oppressors?
That's really nice.
It's a very mature scene.
Yeah.
He does actually, though, prevent the administrator from declaring that Solos is independent.
Yeah, before he gets shot. But that's not his fault. No. You know, that's not, I suppose he's doing the whole Pertwee antagonizing people who could actually help him.
And in fact, everyone, like, people are constantly accusing Kai of speechifying. Like, there's three or four times throughout the episodes where people tell him off. And I think in episode 3 or something, the doctor says, look, it's not a political meeting. Just shut up. And, you know, we're all on your side. Stop with the speeches. So he's a sort of slightly ridiculous figure, I think.
Oh, no, he's not. I've got to counter you. No, Kai is not. Kai is the hero in here, and he's the sympathetic character. And the fact that he argues is because, as we turn on the news, and as we'd later see Professor Jones, you know, the mouthy ones are the good boys and girls, aren't they? The ones that can speak out.
But enough characters mock him for the speechifying.
Because they're all the oldies and squares who aren't getting it.
But the thing is, also, he does learn in that he starts taking action rather than just talking, when he is given the agency to take action. And, of course, he is then the first person to, spoiler alert, at the end, evolve into the energy being.
Mm. And what's the first thing he does? Shoot the marshal.
Yeah, it's questionable. But at the same time, it's like, what other solution is there in the plot at that point?
Pertwee doesn't even object. Just go ahead and shoot him.
No, well, the marshal is about to turn the planet inside out and kill everyone down there.
Yeah, you know, and he's fat.
It's it is morally objectionable. I don't think we're meant to go, yeah, the Marshal's dead. It's meant to be a situation of utter desperation.
But like a glowy rainbow being in a situation of utter desperation.
Yes.
He really looks stupid, though, doesn't he? Like, he really, really looks ridiculous.
That's the thing. It's still divided as how this looks. I don't remember it on black and white, but so I've only ever seen this in colour. And I never bothered to turn the colour down. I think it looks terrific. I really like the trippy weirdness of it. And it's one of the few times where the CSO has actually worked for me.
Mm. They have this new effect too, which is this sort of rainbow glowy thing that they use a couple of times in this story.
John Hollis,
They use it on... Yeah, that's right. And they use it on Kai, and they use it on the box and that sort of thing. And that
they later
like
use it on the Croton, won't they? On the Cronivore.
I think there's something different. I'll talk about that when it comes to
Amy Stewart.
There's something vaguely rude about what they use on the Croton, the name of it, but we'll get into that soon enough. I mean, Doctor Who has been in colour for 3 years now, but it seems every year they do a story that's not just in colour, it's in bloody colour. So, you know, the Ambassadors of Death was in bloody colour, and Claws of Axos, bloody colour. And this year's... Look, we're not just in colour, we're in every colour simultaneously.
And the big scene is, of course, the scene in the big Theseum mine, the big cavern sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really fabulously trippy, you know, with John Hollis.
I do love John Hollis, because John Hollis just plays the same part in everything he ever does.
So he's Professor Sondergaard, he's gone native, he's wearing lots of fabulous
Native
American
gear. Well, he's actually
wearing
a really lovely pink fluffy dressing gown. Have you noticed? It's a lovely dusty pink.
But he's got, it's all sort of...
And then he's got his, yeah,
his gorgeous his necklaces and stuff. His share beads. Yeah. Yeah, that's
his
right.
His accoutrement.
He's Lobot in Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, yes.
He wanders around shadowing, stalking Lando Calrissian with those sort of headphones on.
And he turns up in Blake 7 wearing very little.
Yes, that's right. Doesn't he re-break Villa's arm or something?
No, he treats Villa's broken arm, yeah, to be right. fair.
It does hurt him a lot, though.
Yeah.
Well, it is Villa.
Yeah, that's true.
And he seems to be wandering around with Blore from the Monster of Peladon in that story. I think they're a lovely couple.
Blore, really?
Well, I don't know, but it looks like him. And he doesn't
this
speak.
This show's stupid.
It's been long considered the best of this season.
Has
you
it?
Know, by the Conyo.
Has it?
And the Senti. Yeah, I thought it was.
Is it?
Do I still think it's the best of the season? I think for what it says and for how it does it, yeah, I do.
The weird thing is that they've given Bob Baker and Dave Martin,
the lads
they get
Bristol,
to do the
yeah.
political story, but they're not really up to it. And so everyone's massively overdrawn and overacted.
There like, are some speechy speeches, aren't there?
The Marshal's just a stupid villain, you know.
Oh, no, I think actually, this is the thing. You look at the adults, the colonialists and the people coming back and the political people on television at the time. The Marshal really doesn't stand out as any different.
He's not especially crazy compared to kind of the
He's just very narrow and really driven and really believing in his own spiel. Look at the ones we've got now.
I actually think the politics is the really successful part of the story. I'd possibly argue the only successful part of the story.
Well, I don't know why you don't give that to Mac Hulk to do. Do you know what I mean? Like, Mac Hulk was kind of squandered on the Sea Devils. He created
but the Sea Devils is brilliant.
It is brilliant. It's my favourite of the season. I really like it. It's really strong action adventure. But the politics that we had in the Silurians, as thin as it was there, is nearly absent from the Sea Devils. But the politics, like, Colony in Space is so good. Do you know what I mean? And it plays to Hulk's strengths. But here in The Mutants, you've got these guys who create great spectacle, do you know what I mean, and really memorable images and things in their writing.
Colony in Space,
but their characters are really one note, I think. Just think about Colony in Space, and you have Ash, and you have Winton, and you have Mary, and the Leesons, and Caldwell, who are all really interesting, nuanced characters. And here you've got, like, the Marshal and Stubbs and Cotton and Sondergaard, who are all kind of archetypes, you know. And they're not unwatchable. The performances aren't terrible, you know, except
for
Cotton.
With one exception.
And I feel really bad about that. But the characters are much less nuanced and much less interesting. And so I came into this story expecting it would be this year's Colony in Space and expecting really to like it. But I actually found it a bit tiresome.
No.
You see,
I didn't see that coming, did you?
I know. But I think the archetypal nature of the characters actually serves the story well.
Yeah, I do too.
Because we're in a period of time where the Empire is stagnating, and so
well,
is
gone.
Humanity.
It's actually been gone for several decades.
It's gone. But it means humanity is stagnating as well. The Marshal is simple-minded because he is afraid to use his mind. If we look at Sondergaard came to the planet with certain convictions, which have been disproven, and so he has accepted new ideas. And as such, at one point, he's actually ready to die. You know, not because he wants to die, but because he's like, well, you know, I've lived my life. The Marshal,
but again,
the Marshal is terrified.
Yes,
the Marshal
change.
Is terrified of change because right now he is in command. Trenchard in the Sea Devils, you know, he was removed from his colony and now he's running a prison. Mm-hmm. And he's a little bit bitter about that. But what Trenchard does is he wants to go back to how he was. And like you were describing in the novelization, Nathan, he pictures himself as the great white hero.
He's so much more interesting a character than
the
Marshal.
Because the Marshal hasn't had that power taken away from him. He will do anything to prevent that power being taken away from him. And that does make him single-minded.
Yeah, he's an unsympathetic Colonel Blimp, and it's worth looking at the military antecedents of the Marshal to see that he's actually quite well-rounded.
Yeah.
You talk about Professor Sondergaard, you know, offering to die, but he does it in the most tiresome programmatic scene possible where it's, no, you go on, leave me. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's...
Yeah, but could you imagine any other character in the story doing that?
No, I know, but I just don't need to ever see that scene on television again, you know. And I think that that's it. I think he fills the story with stock characters and fairly stock situations. And so it's less entertaining than it really should be.
I agree.
The only two that don't really work are Cotton and Stubbs.
See, I like both of them as characters.
Yeah, I like the concept.
I just think the idea of a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern should work so well, but they've really just been trained on ice cubes. There's nothing.
I mean, Christopher Cole. Nothing to them. Christopher Cole he's a reliable actor. You know, we've seen him already in Scenes of Death.
Yeah.
But he's not really good with the comedy in this. And, of course, Rick James is...
pretty.
He is very pretty. And he's got a lovely voice. He's got a lovely, morphaic voice. You know,
that just doesn't have any rhythms that standard English speakers...
Yeah, he's great for meditation.
His intonations are West African, that's all, which is why his speech patterns sound kind of jarring
I had wanted that to be my conclusion. I had wanted that to be my conclusion, but I think it's really stilted.
Yeah. You actually think he's really flat.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how much of it is actually a language thing. I don't know that he's necessarily any worse than anybody else.
I mean, I don't think it's just the accent, because that's what I wanted it to be. I wanted to find Rick James's performance acceptable, but it really isn't. And there's that terrible, terrible moment, the cliffhanger to episode 5, where essentially there's no visual evidence of any danger at all. All we get is they're in a room... and Rick James tells them it's very dangerous and we'll all be done for, and then crash bang into the credits. Yeah. And it's, you know, he can't...
In my opinion, he does get one good scene where he rises well to the material, and that's when Stubbs is killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think his reaction to Stubbs' death is really, really good. Perhaps because, you know, he has been underplaying it the whole time, so he underplays that scene as well. But that scene in isolation, he seems genuinely affected by his mate's death.
I was a bit upset by the death of Stubbs, actually, because he is the sympathetic working class character.
I mean, Joe flirts with him when they're locked up, and then the doctor knocks him out, and Joe's like, oh, what did you do that for?
He's a dozen burly, unfooted sailors, hefty sigh of remorse. Look, it's interesting you mentioned Katie just there, Brendan, because... really, I don't see that Rick James's character is doing anything but playing up to the scene in exactly the same way that Katie does in pretty much every scene she's given. It's funny how when you look at Tat Wood's commentary in the About Time things, and he does go on about her batting her eyelids in that Melanie Griffith effed up baby voice that she uses, which I think is a little harsh, but she certainly does play up to a preconceived role of what a girl companion is supposed to be, which is kind of... Did we mention acting tropes this season?
We haven't used the word tropes at all.
We haven't mentioned acting. Tropes. Or something.
I will introduce a new trope to you later in this very episode. So
excited already.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, but I mean, he's really just playing the character up to the scene in a way that there's a kind of, you know, very sort of theatrical way of playing it, not so much a television way, when you've got to underplay because the camera is so intimate, or you've got to diminish your work by a third to two-thirds. Hartnell used to say that to the people he liked on set, is underplay, underplay, keep it all in your eyes, because that's really all the audience is seeing. Don't bother doing anything else. But then Hartnell never told them, put your fingers up, because, you know, that's what everyone else is going to see as well. Take up the whole screen, much as you can. Pertwee does his little tricks as well.
Rub the back of his neck.
Oh yeah, he's got his
his ticks.
Twerks, I believe. Some twerks. You haven't said anything to really say this is a bad story.
Well, I think I have.
Yeah, but that's not unusual. I mean, just to Brendan, really, I don't really say that. Neither of you have actually really said why this is so poor.
I thought you liked it, Brendan.
I don't mind it, but I still don't think it's very good.
Oh, I think it has wonderful symbolism and great stories. You know, Barry Letts actually gave this story.
It's got great commentary.
It's got a great concept. It's high concept, which I believe is a term that Nathan has thrown our way before, and I think this is really worthy of that. You know that Letts actually pitched this story, the Salonians and the 500 segment, quartered to a 2000 rotation. It's all part of his Buddhist trip to Jerry Davis in 66.
Yeah.
And Jerry rejected it, saying, oh, that's too intellectual for a Doctor Who audience, which kind of tells you a lot about the Jerry Davis era, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's tiresome.
And I really like that Letts has these, okay, you may call it weekend Buddhists, and there were a lot of them around in England in the 1970s, a lot of people who were getting into TM, or Transcendental Meditation, and growing mung beans, and watching The Good Life. A lot of people doing that sort of thing in the early 70s, in not just in Britain. No.
I think that is a really strong aspect of the story, and that is that the cyclical thing.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. You know, the cave scenes, just to throw my bit in, really feel like William Blake.
Yeah, beautiful, aren't they?
When he went absolutely cray-cray with his watercolours box, because he did have episodes where he went quite mad and ran around naked and, you know, upset his wife.
Wrote Jerusalem.
It is Mardi Gras weekend.
Yeah, hello. But it's perfect one for Mardi Gras. No, I think it's a really beautiful story with some lovely symbolisms. And I actually really love Garrick Hagen as Kai. I think he makes it. And if you're talking about intimacy and sympathy between Joe Grant and the male lead, I think you've got a much more convincing one here than you do at any other time in this series.
Do you know, when I was writing up my notes for the Peladon one, because I wanted to try and work out which story she has an interplanetary romance, because, you know, I've heard the joke before that Joe cops off, you know, every time she goes to another planet.
She's the William Shatner of Doctor Who, isn't she?
But I couldn't see anything between her and Kai at
really?
All.
No. I mean, there's a very strong platonic thing with them. I don't think it's anything romantic.
Yeah, but no, I don't know. I couldn't see.
You know,
it at
she
doesn't
very
take
much,
a big push though.
No, but there is very much there's a mutual respect between them and a mutual understanding between them. I think
she
that's
actually dashes into that porta cube with alacrity, doesn't she?
Well, doesn't she get dragged in?
Oh, that's what
she
says.
Does
I thought
him.
She dressed quite casually. Yeah.
She follows him. She's wearing a lovely outfit in this story, by the way. Can
it's
I just
very
say it's
practical.
Really awesome?
Is this the yellow boots one? Or
no,
is that
no, no, that's coming up.
That's next.
Yellow
story.
Boots, yellow knickers.
No, this is a sort of weird, sort of brown suit thing.
Brown
it's very
suit,
tight.
No knickers.
She looks
okay.
Lovely. No, she's following him because she's following him because the box opens as he goes past. So.
Yeah, we haven't really left the
we
topic
haven't talked
yet,
about
have we?
The box. So let's. The Doctor's been given a box by the Time Lords. It looks like a kind of crummy football. It
looks like something children of the early 1970s used to put coloured shapes into.
It really
through
yes,
the slots.
I remember that. Yeah. Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
a stealth version, a it's Borg stealth version
of that blue
shape.
Blue and red
hemispherical
thing that
red and blue with yellow shapes. In
yes,
it,
yeah. exactly. Yeah, so
it's the most irritating toy, although it made a very good Death Star spaceship thing later on.
Gosh, I want one of those. Mm. Do they still make them? Do you
think? I think they do, actually.
Sure, it's on eBay for the price of a new car.
Yeah, probably. So this is the Time Lords are really not very competent here. Sandifer comments on this, but pretty much anyone who's ever watched the story knows that the box appears, you know, in the Doctor's laboratory. Joe and the Doctor head off to another planet to deliver the box to someone. The Doctor doesn't know who the box is for. The box opens when Kai goes past, which is why Joe goes chasing
yeah,
him.
That's her excuse. Yeah.
The box opens and it's got tablets in it that Kai can't read and he doesn't understand. And then John Hollis nearby is roped in to do the translation about it. So it's not really the most direct or kind of efficient way of getting a message to someone, really.
No.
You would think Magritte guy from Terror of the Autons could have just popped, you know, into existence in
why
front
didn't
of
they
Kai.
Just, why didn't they just bloody materialise the thing in his lap to start with?
Yeah,
why does it have to... Why is it also... And why didn't Gandalf just send the bloody eagles?
Yes, why didn't the eagles drop the ring
yeah.
into Mount Doom?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I mean, no, or carry the, you know...
They could have dropped Frodo into Mount Doom. Let me try that again.
No, I haven't left Doctor Who.
They could have dropped Frodo. I can't even say it.
But really, the ball should have been Ian McKellen in this story. He was around. And he would have made quite a nice little bit of tasty what? Cottage pie out of Kai, I think, in his story in this one.
Well, come 2012, the ball was Ian McKellen in Doctor Who and the Snowmen.
Yeah.
At Christmas. With the giant snow globe, voiced by Sir Ian McKellen.
Do we have
we own him.
Is the listener still with us, do you think?
Actually gone off to...
Wake up, dear.
He'll disentangle all of this in post, don't worry.
Richard, coming back to something you were saying earlier, like, why is this still a bad story? I've been thinking about that.
I don't... Well, it isn't.
Well,
gentle listener,
that's the
I
thing.
Don't agree.
It's a good story, which has been executed very poorly, in my opinion. You have...
How is that? Okay, go on.
You know what? You have a very strong guest cast. You have Paul Whitson-Jones. You have George Prafter. Mm-hmm. You have Jeffrey Palmer. Oh,
lots
you have John
of
Hollis.
Yeah, George Prafter. Lots of John Hollis. The bloke from the beginning of Monty Python.
Yes.
You have the It's guy from Monty Python,
For me, I think the big problem is, and I know we've just kind of glossed over this, but I've been thinking about it, and the big problem is Stubbs and Cotton.
Rosencrantz
and Guildenstern. Because they're our main audience identification figures with the world of Skybase.
Yeah.
And then just not very interesting. They're not terribly sympathetic. Like, you know, we don't really care about them until one of them dies. And even then, we kind of care because there is an emotional reaction among the cast.
Why do you think we don't care?
I actually think it is the thing that I identified before, is the characters are just types. None of them are particularly interesting.
That's the thing. They need interesting performers. Like the Marshall works because he's giving a really interesting performance.
I've just got one thing to say to all of you. I'm sorry, James Acheson. And it's his first go on this. Have we got there yet? They're the best looking monsters to have appeared in Doctor Who almost so far. And I'm sorry I jumped in there quickly, but hey, it's a podcast. It looks gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it's great moments.
You know what? Yeah, the design's good. But
I also like that it nods to Solaris, which had just come out that year. With the name of Solus.
Yeah.
And the Skybase thing. And I mean, it's about as much like Solaris as, you know, the goodies is like the Brandenburg Concerto whenever Graham gets on the computer organ. But we can go on for it forever. I think maybe the listener needs to decide. I actually think it's my highlight of the season as what it's saying, us as a story.
But what it's saying is not exactly a spectacular moral insight. Do you know what I mean? Like, oppressing people and stealing all their stuff is wrong.
It's bad.
You know, like, it's not
and how
bad.
We deal with it. And I look, anything that shows up the moral impunity of these characters is not a bad thing.
Yeah. But I think the moral thing is sort of really basic. And I think the fact that the Marshal is sort of a moustache-twirling villain, it makes it less interesting than it should be.
I think Pertwee's also most likable in this story as to any of them this year.
Well,
Pertwee is really sympathetic
in this. Again, it's Pertwee's new instinctive attraction to progressive causes, which we're starting to see all the time.
I really like the Doctor in this story. He's more like the Doctor. I've got to say, I didn't get a chance to say it last season, but it's actually taken now, for me, 2 years to accept him as the Doctor.
Yeah,
watching
I think
him
I feel the same
around.
Way.
He's the least doctorish doctor I've seen, and I'm thinking later doctors as well. I actually have about as much trouble with him as I do with the other Baker as the Doctor.
The other Baker.
Yeah, and I'm surprised at that. I certainly have great fondness for Colin now through his audio work, but I think it's having heard Barry Letts's two audio versions for Mr. Pertwee in the 90s, it's not quite the same thing.
Can I say a word about George Prafter for a moment?
Oh, please do. Nice lab.
Yeah, he's got a really nice lab. He's probably, for me, the most interesting character in the whole thing.
He's very sympathetic in everything he does, isn't he?
Well,
he pitches it, really.
It's interesting because he is built up as being a sympathetic character, and the Doctor starts to change his thinking on, maybe we shouldn't turn the planet inside out and kill everyone.
Yeah.
Mm. And then he just goes ahead and tries to do it
anyway.
You know, in a way, he's more evil than the Marshal because he's been introduced as a character who does have a conscience and does think about the effect on other people, but he's going to bloody do this thing anyway because he just doesn't care. And that, I think, is very effective, and the Doctor's disappointment in him
is
very
true.
And the blandness.
The
blandness of his evil, yeah.
Mm. Is that true, though? The Marshal kind of railroads him into doing it.
Yeah, but he doesn't really object, does he?
And then in episode, in front of the Inquisitor or whoever it is who arrives at the very end.
Who looks like a Time Lord.
Yeah, he arrives at the end and he's never in it again, but I kept thinking, surely he played a Time Lord at some point, but he doesn't. I think George Prafter's character, who's called Jaeger, I think, testifies against him or is kind of horrified by the Marshal.
Yeah, he plays Frederick Jaeger.
He does play Frederick Jaeger, I was thinking.
With that unfortunate accent and unfortunately that unfortunate line, I was just following orders.
Well, it is
with
that
the same accent.
You know, again, I don't think any of the characters rise to the level of complexity where, you know, you could say anything so definitive about what Jaeger's like as a person. I think he's just kind of pushed around by whatever the plot needs.
I think he's the most realistic, therefore.
For me, this could have actually been the best story of the season if more care had been taken with it. And I think it's a great shame. I think it's a great improvement for the Bristol boys over Claws of Axos.
No, because I think it's their fault that it's crappy.
Oh, okay. I think it's the direction.
Right. Yeah, no. I think it's because they've written a whole heap of, like, of stock programmatic characters who aren't very interesting.
I think it's up to the listener to decide.
Yes, absolutely.
With an exciting new review. To decide. We haven't talked about Tristram Carey's last score for the program, and I've got to say, it's really kind of sad that he's gone from such beautiful levels with the Daleks and Master Plan he did as well, didn't he, and how sophisticated and elegant they were. And then there's this one, I'm just going, well, I'm sitting here thinking, what, who's opened the fridge? It's just really glaring.
It's what we're doing in 1972, isn't it?
I know he had very little time and he was a last-minute addition. Whoever else they had on wasn't available, and Carey, I think, by that time was, you know, moving to Australia and doing other things and lost a lot of money with his lab, his state-of-the-art cutting-edge, simply because of machines like the Delaware were cutting him out so quickly. Tech was moving so fast. And poor old Carey was just kind of doing everything, quick little jobs where he could, from what I know. But, yeah, really, this is really irritating score. In a year of interesting scores.
It is disappointing. But
well, that's a harsh word.
Well, it's disappointing because, as you say, you know, he's been so good in the past and would continue to be good.
That's the trump card in ending any relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, you were so good in the past.
Disappointing.
But as you mentioned earlier, Richard, first story of James Acheson.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. And you know, I really like the Mutt costumes. I think they're pretty much a really effective update of the Zombie.
I was actually thinking that as well. They're like sort of scary ants made of leather instead of fiberglass,
Which means they move a bit more naturally as one can in a giant ant costume.
They're beautifully lit too, which helps.
Yes,
I just love them.
But they also, like, they're scary looking, but they're sympathetic, and they have a lot of sort of sad eyes. I mean, they look like sort of sea devil eyes. You know, it's the same kind of eyes.
You see them again cropping up on Sarn.
Yes.
I also really like the...
In Brain of Morbius.
I also really like the Skybase uniforms.
The Kinky Devil. They actually do look a bit like Bernard Cribbins in Vinyl, don't they?
Yes, they do. So just before we head right into the end of the season, Rod didn't have much to say about this story. But I think my favourite comment that he did make, I think it's the cliffhanger to episode 4, he described as the best depressurizing airlock scene ever.
Oh, gosh, it's terrible, isn't it?
Is he a Blake 7 fan?
So, the next episode, there's a gaping CSO hole in the wall, and the marshal just walks out of the room while everyone else is sort of trying not to be sucked
utterly
down.
Utterly ridiculous.
Awful.
Yeah. Well, we've just taken a little gap between now and now.
Is that why you're naked except for a swaddling cloth?
Yes, well, I've just been played by the baby from next door. This is, of course, the Time Monster.
Brendan doesn't look that different from the baby from next door. He's still impressively youthful.
You're just saying that because I don't have any hair. Nathan, I think this was one of yours again.
Well, this is just terrible, isn't it?
I'm going to start by saying, God, I love this story.
Thank
but
you.
It is terrible.
It's Robert Sloman, and the thing that nobody gets with this story, dear listener, is that it's written as a comedy.
Oh, then why isn't it funny, though?
Because it's 1972, and it's a feminist comedy, and it's one of the few ones that actually has a lovely little sparring thing between an overtly queer character and a dominant feminine character, and apparently that's not a good thing to be. No, I think it's grating because people don't like the politics of it.
It's absolutely not that. It's that it's just really not very good.
It's this weird tension of we have a plot which is essentially Bobbins and just
Bobbins?
Quite terrible, but everyone's having a really great time, except reportedly for Pertwee.
And us and the people watching it.
No. I have an amazing time watching this. But oddly, the thing Pertwee really didn't like was conceptual science fiction. He liked stories to be grounded in reality. It's like, well, you're on the wrong show.
What's he
perhaps
talking about? It's got Ingrid Pitt in a flouncy, trouncy, bouncy, busty outfit.
Yes.
That's pretty real.
So, but in a way, this actually works in Pertwee's favour, because he did complain to Terence about the script and how he didn't think the script made any sense. But he also then said, you know, I will do it because my job is not to enjoy the scripts.
We'll pass that on to the audience.
He said, my job is to say the words with the best conviction I can manage. So even if I am not enjoying myself...
Which is all he ever did, you might want to add.
If I am not enjoying myself, even if I don't believe what I'm saying, the children at home must believe it.
But can you hear Patrick Troughton's response to that? Was you could just, or indeed Laurence Olivier's, well, just try acting. You know, how about elevating that to the next level where you actually experience and have some feeling for it? Don't just read the bloody lines with conviction. Be somebody. Well, we're not up to three doctors yet, but I bet we'll have a lot to say.
Yeah.
I think that it really is evident in that scene in episode 2 where he's explaining who Kronos is to Dr. Ruth Ingram and Sergeant Benton.
She's a fat bird in a white frock and a fireman's hat and painted white.
The thing is, he has to do all this sort of babble, and he has this beautiful line, which I'll come back to, which is along the lines of, the Atlanteans believed in Kronos and thus brought him into existence and imprisoned him in the crystal.
Buddhist.
It's very Buddhist, but apparently John just went, oh God, this is terrible. But in that scene, the Doctor isn't speculating. The Doctor is saying, this really happened. The Doctor is essentially saying magic happened, but he convinces me in that scene.
But it's a Buddhist thing, isn't it? Interstitial time. It's actually a concept of Tibetan Buddhism.
There is much more Buddhism in this than you think, and it is...
I'll just pat my Yeti while I'm saying that, so to speak.
Your disused Yeti.
Yes.
God, I need to shave my legs.
Brendan's hugging the disused Yeti as we speak. There'll be a photo to accompany this.
There's a euphemism.
So every year, after Dix and Let's take over, every year we get a six-part
Let's
season.
And Dix. It does sound like a euphemism, doesn't it? Let's and Dix.
It really isn't. there's a six-part season finale. It's by Letts and Sloman, essentially,
mm-hmm.
although sometimes Letts is credited and sometimes he isn't. In fact, he's never credited.
So never credited.
But it's a huge input from him. And there's always sort of spirituality and Buddhism. So last year in The Demons, we discovered for the first time that Doctor Who can say that an alien is responsible for some aspect of magic or human mythology or something like that. And we get that again this year. It's Kronos, who is a titan in Greek mythology. There's a Minotaur. There's all of these things which are caused by, you know, sort of strange alien
is
beings.
Is Richard Dawkins
and stuff.
An atheistic alien, do you think? Do you think he's actually an Azal? Richard Dawkins, do you think he could be? I think I'll have to ask Lala Ward. Can we ring her up?
She would know.
Yeah.
We should ring her up
and
leave
her. I think we might get a rather curt reply.
She said at a convention she's married monsters in the past. So,
so it's very similar, and we'll get this sort of Buddhist sort of stuff as well. And
if only there was a Buddhist we could know. We knew in fandom we could check in with and see if this is...
Well, I know a little bit about Buddhism, and the... There is a hugely, massively Buddhist moment, of course, which is the flower sermon in episode 6.
There is too.
Yeah,
where Pertwee tells the story of his blackest day, and he goes and meets the hermit halfway up a mountain, who we later discover will be Kanpo Rinpoche.
And Queen Darius.
King Dalius in this episode. It's the same actor.
Mm.
And, you know, it's the flower sermon.
Queen Darius.
We'll have to talk about that later, because... I've got lots of juicy things to say about Galea, who I think is just fantastic. She's the highlight of this story. So there is sort of overtly Buddhist stuff. But the other thing that Letts and Sloman do in the season finale every year is give us a fun unit romp. Do you know what I mean? And so that's why everyone remembers these things as being such fun. You know, The Demons was fun. This is kind of fun. It is terrible, but it's kind of fun. The Green Death is the one that they get right, where it's actually a good story as well as being a fun unit romp. And then there's Planet of the Spiders, where all the unit people are back and it's really not very good. So it is a pattern that they sort of set every year. And I think the two reasons why this story is so terrible are the dialogue is shockingly bad all the way through, like absolutely absurdly ridiculous. And it's all that Cretan jazz and the whole King Arthur bit and like simmer down, stew. Everyone sort of speaks in this sort of absolutely fake, appalling way. You know, the Brigadier is suddenly a giant fool who can't really understand anything that's going on and doesn't believe all the other things that are going on. dialogue is just painful to listen to. Like, really, really atrociously bad. Joe says groovy twice.
Far too often.
Twice.
Feels like it, well, apparently the whole interstitial universe is groovy.
You see, I feel like the dialogue is actually really nicely quirky. We have the two scientific characters, we have Ruth and Stu, who, as well as being scientists, they are a comedy double. But
they're not a funny comedy double.
As well as being scientists, they have a pre-existing relationship as brother and sister. You know, they banter with each other and they tease each other. And it's that kind of familiar relationship that we don't see often.
And she's Butch and his Femme. It's a perfect television for the early 70s.
I do have something to say about her whole... The treatment of her as a feminist is very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's the first time that Doctor Who is actively doing feminism and doing women's lib, and they actually call it by name. God bless women's lib and all who say it. You know, it's incredibly awkward. It's incredibly awkwardly done.
It's roughly handled.
I think the cast do the best they can with the material they've got. I think Delgado probably handles it best because he is sexist towards her. But when he apologises, Delgado's master hasn't shown signs of sexism before. He's courteous to a fault with everyone until he needs to kill you. Mm. And again, he shows actually no intent that he ever seems ready to hurt Ruth. Mm. And I don't think he ever intends to hurt Stuart either. He just gets in the way, you know what I mean? But I think one of the really questionable moments of Ruth's status as a feminist, if you like, is when Stu is kind of gently asking, oh, come on, you know, we should give it a try. We're just as qualified, this, that, the other. And her response is, don't bully me, Stu, or I'll burst into tears.
But I actually think that was a line that I thought was meant to be funny.
It's a really lovely character moment, but it's also saying, oh, yes, we're doing all this feminism stuff, but really women will just manipulate you by crying. Coming back to my other
passion. Thank you for that, Judith Lucy moment. Yeah. Is that your other passion?
Yeah. Coming back to my other passion, of course, which is video games. I imagine most of the listeners will have heard of Super Mario Brothers. It's kind of a thing. And one of the central conceits of that is most games start with Princess Peach Toadstool being kidnapped by Bowser, the king of the turtles, and Mario having to go and save her. And, you know, so it's obviously... The woman is kidnapped and the man has to save her life. About 10 years ago, they made a game called Super Princess Peach, where Mario was kidnapped and Peach had to go rescue him.
They've watched an episode of The Avengers, haven't they? From 1960, blah. Yeah.
But Peach's superpowers, like Mario's superpowers, are throwing fireballs or freezing things or turning into a raccoon. Peach's superpowers involve emotions. She gets angry at people and hits them, or she cries a river and the enemies get swept away.
So it is the Delgado and Pertwee.
it's kind of that thing of women will manipulate you with their emotions still exist today. That being said, it was a decent game, and Peach got to be a hero and beat lots of people up. Ruth is a decent character, and she is strong and she is intelligent, but there's still this tension in there of, but you're a woman. Interestingly,
it's 1972, and it is how
they do that to Sarah Jane when she turns up.
She's not having a bar of it, though.
No. I mean, the writers do it to her. Like, they try and make her look like an idiot. You know what I mean? Maybe Liz doesn't have a bar of it, but Holmes is a bit mean to Sarah Jane as a character.
Holmes likes that kind of underplay of cruelty, doesn't he? He likes throwing that in.
He makes Sarah say things that make her look like an idiot, sort of thing. Yeah. The murder in the cup time of tea. Warrior.
I was just actually adding that.
But Ruth does then get to recover a bit. You know, she goads Sergeant Benton into action, like, are you just going to sit here? And then, you know, when they're trying to control Tom Tit again after the Master's left, she's like, right, Stu, disconnect the thermolobes and load up the helmic regulator. Oh, what do you want me to do? You stand there and look pretty. I love that as well. So generally, I love her character. The only thing I don't really like about her character is that she's not Liz. We're in Cambridge, they should have got Liz back.
Well, we didn't even mention her, did we?
No.
So can I tell you about the second thing that I think makes this story terrible?
if you must.
The plot is just absolute garbage. It's so bad. It's full of all of these sort of elements.
I disagree with you again. Go on.
All of these elements. So Stu becomes an old man for no real reason and then gets younger an episode later again for no real reason. None of the characters actually does this to him or fixes it. It just happens and then it unhappens. The Master has Dr. Percival for the first two episodes as his sidekick, and then Kronos kills him for no other reason than he's got another sidekick, and we don't want all these sidekicks cluttering up the place. Everyone gets to move very slowly for an episode for no reason, and then Pertwee rescues them. You know, the Master ejects Pertwee into the time vortex, and 2 minutes later, Joe retrieves him by pressing a button on the TARDIS console. Do you know what I mean? The Doctor spends half an episode building the time flow analog. It works for 10 seconds, has no discernible effect, and then it explodes for no reason. Baby Benton appears in one scene, and then in a scene at the end. He's clearly only there to give us the hilarious, you know, tag scene at the end of episode six. All these elements come in and go absolutely precisely nowhere. They just get resolved as quickly as they come up, and all they're doing is marking time. And it's exactly what Sloman did with the heat barrier the previous year. Do you know what I mean? Like at the end of The Demons, we complained and complained about the pacing problems of The Demons. Here, this barely has a plot. It's just a bunch of things that happen.
See, I think that's because it's 3 two-parters. It's 3 two-part stories written in the style of a 40s serial. It's Robert Sloman playing with the ideas of time. So what does time do to you? It ages you. Okay, we'll have a character age. Okay, I've had someone age, now I'll youth someone. Ah, now what if I had people in one speed of time and people in another speed of time? So we'll put that in. We'll freeze people in time. Now, I'm not saying it's really well done. And you probably should have... you probably should have focused on one or two things. But at the same time, none of the ideas stick around long enough to outwear their welcome.
No, sometimes they stick around for like 5 minutes of screen time. Don't you think the time flow analogue outstays its welcome?
Not really, because I'd always thought the time flow analogue was a bit silly until I rewatched it recently for the podcast. And I was specifically looking for something in the plot that justifies the bloody time flow analogue. It's Crasus's pendant. The Master takes the pendant and uses the geometric designs on it as a constant in terms of measurement, in terms of time. In the original script, the Master actually has the line of, it doesn't matter if something is centimetres or inches, so long as the measurements remain constant with each other.
He talks about the ratios of proportions.
Yeah, exactly. And that is how the Doctor explains the time flow analogue as well. It is not the items that are important. It is how they are arranged in relationship to each other.
No, he talks about their molecular structure as well. You can't retrieve that.
I can and I just
You know, Gareth can. Gareth Roberts, of course, has a sort of loving tribute to the stupid time flow analogue in The Lodger, where he creates that giant thing out of umbrellas and things. and the Doctor even tries to pass it off as a piece of modern art, which is what both of them... it's what both of them do.
I think actually Nana Muscuri was wearing it on her earlier appearances on the two Ronnies. She'd just broken through in the charts. Because, you know, with the Junta, or with the Greek military uprising in 67, you had a lot of Greek people coming into London, and there were lots of restaurants and, you know, and there were Domardis and there were doner kebabs, although I think they had just ouzo over them. But, you know, it was the Greek thing, was the trendy thing.
All that Cretan jazz.
All that, exactly. And the and terracotta wigs and sensibilities. But no, Nana Muscuri that year, she'd been charting and she'd be on the two Ronnies and wearing exactly that pendant. So with the backing vocals provided by that big umbrellary machine,
Can we go to Atlantis?
Look, you know what? Gorgeous sets. So my default point is I think it's stunning. And you know what? The principal players are not that bad.
I think Dalios is a bit of a worry, but...
Oh, he's lovely.
I love Ingrid Pitt in this.
Oh,
it's impossible
she's
not
amazing.
To. We actually get proper BBC Shakespeare-ish classics with her performance. And in fact, with the sets and the look of this, this would not have been at all odd for any of the viewers sitting at home who are at school at the time or maybe in professions like yours, that she's totally convincing as a BBC Classics naughty old Medea type of Queenie type person.
In fact, she's really explicitly sneaking around on Dalias, of course, because she says, you know, she's talking with her maid and they're talking about
Hippias. I shall have a bit of that one. She's actually the Joan Collins of the ancient world, isn't she?
Or Mae West.
You get the impression that she's had an affair
with... She won't sink.
You do get the impression that she's already had an affair with Hippias.
Oh, yeah. Certainly.
She says she has.
She knows that he'd cloy on her tongue.
Well, he says, when he comes in, I was expecting to see the sympathetic and shy young girl, and now I've got this ice queen.
But he also says that he expected to be sent on a message, for some other lordling. So there are other people. And then, of course, she fancies the master something rotten.
I like that. I shall have that one, yes.
And the master tries his charm on her, and she's not having a bar. It's like, no, you are my queen.
She's actually very convincing in her royal disposition. And when she meets Joe, it's one of those few scenes that Katie's given where both characters are entirely sympathetic and really believable. The queen looks at her and says, what's this handshake, and why would I repeat myself? She's willing to come forward and willing to meet, but never forget her position.
Yes.
Yeah. I think she plays terrific. Really well.
Mm. Yeah, she might be the best thing in it.
Well, it's just a relief to get someone who's acting.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Also acting, of course, is Kronos.
Straight from the pants people. I love that. Yeah, well, where do we go with
that? So it really must be, is it the worst realised monster so far?
I think the biggest problem is...
When that Joan Sutherland hadn't finished with the frock before they put it onto Kronos the Carnivore. Yeah.
I think the big problem is just showing it. Don't show it. Keep the camera out of focus.
Well, and they do try and do that.
I mean, they have the birds flapping. And originally the appearance effect was going to be with a variety of different birds flapping. So you would just see all these wing shapes.
Yeah.
And a ghostly ethereal being would come out of it. And of course we got the Doctor Who equivalent instead.
Yeah, which is really terrible. And they try and hide it. The scene where it attacks Atlantis at the end, it's barely visible. Clearly the director has said, get that thing out of my shot. And they do the thing too where they kind of, it's very white and they light it and they hope that it's going to flare out the videotape.
Yes. Front axial projection.
Oh, they do use front axial projection, do they?
Axial projection. So,
Not quite enough of it though.
Dear listener, for those of you who don't know, front axial projection is when you paint a costume or object with a certain
phosphorescent, or
it's not reflective. Phosphorescent. It's sort of reflective.
Pearlescent. Yeah. Silver Nemesis will do it. We'll also see it next year in The Green Death. And then when you shine a light on it, the light reflects, but it doesn't reflect the way a mirror would. It sort of absorbs the light first and then reflects it back a millisecond later, meaning you get a glowing effect rather than a reflection effect.
Well, you do. There are some shots where you can see it is kind of blowing
it
out the videotape.
Yeah. I just kind of wish they'd done it with just the shadow of the creature, like you sort of see the flapping.
I've never seen. Look, thank you. There's that cat people, the Jacques Tourneur film of 1942.
And its sequel, both excellent films.
It was not as successful, but he also did, we've mentioned him before, but he's a terrific early RKO horror director whose shots would have been perfect for this story. You never see the cat, you never see the villains, you just see the shadows on the wall. Gee, it works well.
It was also the first film to use that technique, which is so famous in horror films, which is having silence, 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 and then a loud noise.
No. Oh, that's called Tristram Cary.
But the loud noise is then something non-threatening. So
surprise!
Where it's used in Cat People is she is walking along the side of the street and she thinks she can hear
the cat. She comes up and she's no, sorry.
She can hear the cat.
We should
and
probably
then
come back to it.
There is a hissing sound like a big panther, and my God,
it's John Nathan Turner.
No, it's the hydraulic door of a bus.
Oh. How often those two have been confused.
I would like to get a sample of you saying surprise and make that my text tone.
I was thinking that was Hippias.
Can I just say though, I actually really love the jumping around that this story does.
Hello, where's this come?
Because, well, exactly. Doctor Who, for the past few years, really since The Chase, hasn't had a story that's set in two locations continuously. The closest we get is Inferno and Day of the Daleks.
There's a reason for that.
But in this story, there's something exciting about it because the story twists and turns so much. You don't know where you're going next.
Because you get the scenes in the TARDIS in the middle, and then you get Atlantis and stuff.
Yeah. And, but I think also it's just before that, you've got Unit HQ. You've got the Cambridge lab. You've got the rooms around Cambridge. Then you've got the convoy on its way. Then you've got the TARDIS. Mm. Then you've got Atlantis, and then it all comes back. Look, it's messy, don't get me wrong, but I think it's also really exciting that they are trying something new. Like we were saying with the mutants, and I know you don't agree, Richard, but if there is a criticism that could be laid at that story, it is perhaps that the characters are stagnant character models, that we have seen this type of story before.
Mm.
For better or for worse, I don't think you can say you've seen anything like the Time Monster before.
No. I'm very fond of this story. I do think it could have done with some judicious cutting and perhaps losing a couple of episodes. But I can think you can say that for a lot of the six-parters, except for the Sea Devils, maybe, just because there's so much going on.
I think, I mean, it's worth talking about what sort of badness the Pertwee era does. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that this is probably the worst story. Maybe Monster of Peladon is worse. But I think it's still enjoyable. The worst Pertwee story.
Really?
Time Monster?
Saying quite a lot.
I wouldn't say that.
I wouldn't say that. I find it very entertaining.
But
I'm saying,
even a bad Pertwee story is actually pretty entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the big regular cast, you've got people doing their party pieces, you know, you've got the master. Like, all of that stuff is actually quite fun. And so I enjoy this. I didn't think that The Demons was as good as I remembered it last year, but I still thought it was pretty enjoyable. So I think that even when there's a misfire like this story, that it never falls below a certain level of competence and a certain level of entertainment value. There's nothing in the Pertwee era to kind of equal, you know, the Celestial Toymaker. Do you know what I mean? It never goes that wrong.
We don't have John Wiles, that's why.
Yeah, that's it.
Although there is a point of the story that seems to draw more ire than anything else. The TARDIS set.
Thank you for getting back to that. Do you love it?
Yes.
I love it as well.
We've all made cupcakes at home. We can all see the point of those walls. This is what people don't get. The Capelli designs that were really featured strongly in the 68 Milano design fair in Italy that you subsequently see turning up, the Vacform plastic and the fiberglass things that you see, the Werner Pampen things of the early 60s, but pretty much watch every episode of Space 1979 or everything that was made in the early 70s, those beautiful formed white furniture thing. This is absolutely contemporaneous, and it's good design. I like it. Yeah. I'm actually kind of disappointed that they didn't upgrade the console to go with it, and I think that's why the set doesn't work. It was called modular, the whole look and that lettering. You know, the microgramma lettering, the space style that you see on Space 1999 that ends up on Skybase in that whole look is very much of this period. They didn't actually go far enough with it, and I think that's why it didn't work.
I also think it's a great relief given how tired and minimal the TARDIS set had been during the Pertwee era. We've only seen it a few times, but
pretty
it's like
perfunctory.
Corner of the room.
Well, it's a corner of your dad's office, isn't it? Including the filing cabinet.
And you know, like those terrible photographic blow-ups and stuff. Yeah. It was looking really tired. And
this is groovy.
And I love how the Master's version has a chocolate fountain in the middle of it.
Well. I'm sorry, is that another euphemism?
No, his time rotor looks like a chocolate fountain.
No, it was a euphemism. I don't think you should be using that kind of language. This is a family podcast.
Fine, I won't invite you around for fondue.
Well, no, we've done that. But anyway, I really do think it's a shame that the console is staying in the Brakaki original. And how sexy would it have looked with a slightly curved, moulded... My pick of the episode would be to go and look at any of Colani's designs, which are very much influenced of this form of circularity and curvaceousness and a Kalani console. I might do a little drawing and stick it on the website to show just how fabulous this whole story might have been with, oh, goodness, what a fanboy thing to do. But anyway.
I think that's a wonderful idea, Richard. I really hope you do that.
Homework for me.
Now, I have been unresting in my praise of this story, I suppose. And I will say the one thing I find that's kind of problematic about it is it's really starting to see... the sort of dumbing down of Unit.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah. Yes. It's getting a little... Nathan, what's the word you'd use?
Exhausting.
That's the one. Thank you.
You know, it also doesn't help that all three of them need a jolly good haircut.
They're a bit wet, aren't they? Yeah. They're a bit damp. I don't think it's just that they don't have a blow dryer. They're a bit soggy.
Brigadier's really stupid.
Well, he's cranky.
Yeah.
And mouthy. Benton actually, I think, is the most sympathetic. I really like the way Benton takes on the master.
Yeah, that is it's good.
It's convincing.
Yeah, it
actually works. Well, mate, you just try it.
But I love the master going, "No, Mr. Benton, that was the oldest trick in the book." Yeah. He's fabulous. It's
that's why the master won't kill any of them, because he's having too much.
He loves them.
Yes, yeah. Benton is easily the most capable member of unit in this story. Everything that happens, Brigadier says, "Oh no, that can't possibly be happening." It's like you've bloody seen spaghetti monsters.
Yeah, it's a bit Counselor Troy mid-run Next Generation trick when we just have to reboot every episode because, you know, we're in syndication. Doctor Who doesn't have that excuse. Doctor Who was the first series to properly story arc. Soap operas don't count. And they're forgetting it, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's a shame, really, because it seems like the reason they're doing it is to make the Doctor seem more clever. And I know I've said on the podcast that one of the things I really hate in any kind of storytelling is making one character look clever, not by making them look clever, but by making the people around them look stupid.
It's bad child rearing, isn't it? You don't do it in a family, and you don't do it with your school charges either. Yeah.
But also, it actually just makes your hero look more stupid. Like Pertwee said, with Carrie John not going down in the caves in a miniskirt, he would say Doctor Who would not work with someone who would do something like that.
Because it actually brings the Doctor down in the end. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so to speak. Are we still talking about miniskirts?
And the fun thing about the Brigadier was that in some ways he was sort of more savvy than the Doctor.
But would appear not to be.
He was amused by the Doctor, you know, and that we talked about that sort of curl of the lip and that kind of wry and attitude. He was smart, he was clever, he was kind of funny. But here he's turning into a blustering idiot. It's only going to get worse, spoiler alert, in the next story at the start of next year. And I think it's a big shame.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a degeneration of his character. I don't think this is where he's headed from here on in. Do you know what I mean?
It's an aberration. It's a blip, thankfully.
But the trouble is, it's a blip in a story that Barry Letts has his fingerprints all over.
Yeah. Well, as Richard said earlier, I do think this story is an attempt to do a proper comedy. It's not the Romans.
Doctor Who has found it very difficult to support comedy every time it's attempted, which isn't very often.
That's true.
For some reason, it just doesn't work. Now, my biggest disappointment in this story, as you've said, is that the Brigadier is so poorly served. And you do notice throughout the last few seasons that it's only Nick's sidelines and sardonic grin or a certain little thing that he'll throw in that elevates the character. He's really poorly served and underwritten. It's a bit dumbed down.
Yeah. So.
Just before we go on to our Jenny Lairds and our picks of the week, in Walsh Watch.
Pervy, windowy, washy Walsh Watch.
Terry Walsh plays a window cleaner who is surprised by a vase appearing out of thin air. Surprise! And falls down from a ladder. So that's Walsh Watch for this season.
It's so terrible, though, because the Brigadier and some...
He does a lovely pratfall, though. It's really good.
Yeah. But the Brigadier and some civil servants come along.
Feel him up a bit.
And they go, oh, he's still alive. And then the civil servants just sort of walk
off.
Doing their thing.
No, I love that, because it shows what a bastard the civil servant is.
Yeah,
it's a cut price Steve.
It's a bit of a shame that he doesn't get his comeuppance. He just sort of disappears from the plot.
Yeah.
Oh, you see him later on arguing and being ticked off by the Doctor. So.
Coming back to something you were saying earlier, Nathan, I've been thinking about it. The Master does have a lot of instances of starting off with one henchman and then swapping them halfway through the story after they're brutally murdered or
hench
something.
Hench swapping,
yes.
There's a lot of that in the early 70s,
The only one who actually survives is Captain Chin Lee when she's swapped out for Mela.
That's true.
Well, that's because she was also married to the director, so she wasn't going to be lost.
She was going to be killed off.
She wasn't going to be lost in a hench swapping party. Yeah. She would not have been left behind.
Yeah. Although, you know what, if I were married to a writer and the writer said, oh, I'm going to put you in a TV script, I would actually say, oh, can you give me a really good death scene? Like, can I
Darling.
Be burned to death or something?
Wow.
You know, get your aggression out on me that way.
It's an interesting relationship paradigm.
Tell us more. Yeah. Lie down here on this couch.
What's Rod's comment on that one?
What do you think his paintings are about? Okay, so... we move on to that time of the season, the Jenny Laird Awards for Most Puzzling Creative Choice. Nathan, would you like to go first?
Well, my Jenny Laird Award goes to 3-time Academy Award winner Jim Acheson. So he can put this on his mantelpiece next to his Oscars.
One for Amadeus.
He did the Spider-Man, the last 3 Spider-Man costumes.
Yeah, the same designer who designed Tom Baker's costume designed the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. Mm.
So he did the costumes for the mutants, but he gives both Jeffrey Palmer and George Pravda these unbelievably terrible dresses, which make them look paunchy and have like giantly narrow shoulders and a hugely hideously unflattering.
He did do mid-career Time Lords, didn't he? He did do Time Lords for Deadly Assassin 2, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, his crustacea collars.
But they have shoulders, do you know what I mean? Poor old Jeffrey Palmer comes in, you know, he's fabulous, but I'm just distracted by how incredibly pigeon-chested.
Don't forget how Hugh Walters was dressed as Runcible. But even then,
you're right. They had very solid shoulders.
No, these people are shoulderless. It's really terrible. Yeah. And then finally, the investigator turns up and seems to be wearing a sort of brass judge's wig. So, like, maybe it was a day off.
I'm a judge, you know.
Maybe it was a bad day.
Richard, what's your Jenny Laird Award?
My puzzling choice has to go to one of my heroes, as Nathan just did then, because I know that how much he really does love Mr. Acheson. My puzzling thing is poor old Tristram Carey, who I've always loved and everything he's done. And just the score for the mutants is honestly the weakest point for me in an otherwise pretty good season. Dun, 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 as they fall down the stairs. It's been a series of very much of wild experimentation, and that doesn't always end up successfully, does it, for the viewer or the... You don't think so?
I think it's the difficult second album. Do you know what I mean? I think they get season 8 pretty right. It's a reboot of the show. Season 9, it's kind of like, what do we do now?
Ratings are more successful this time around, though, weren't they? Ratings were doing very well, around the 10s.
Yeah, ratings were constantly in the high 9s, with quite a few episodes breaking the 10s as well.
I think it's enjoyable and iconic, and I think that'll be even more so next year. But I think maybe this is weaker than last year.
Great.
Well, you know, it's quite funny. My Jenny Laird Award relates to the mutants as well.
He's saying this, dear listener, covered in glitter.
Covered in glitter.
He actually is.
So it's a mutant trifecta. It's getting all of the Jenny Laird Awards.
There's a pink one under your left eye. And this is true, listener. And a gold one just near your nostril there. It's like watching
it's like
the top
a beauty
of the
mark.
Pops. It is.
I was just going to say, you know, this season is
filled with
strong female characters. You've got Anat. You've got Third Officer Blythe, you've got Ruth Ingram, you've got Galea. You've even got, in The Curse of Peladon, Alpha Centauri, who is a genderqueer character. She's actually one of the first progressive genderqueer characters.
Coming with its own toys.
The end, the ambassador from Earth, who is the chairperson of the whole committee, is a woman.
A fabulous Amazonian.
You know, she doesn't have anything to do in the plot, but she is still a woman in a position of power.
And some amazing...
On an admittedly backward planet where they've said only women of royal birth can enter the throne room. We'll see more of that later with Peladon. So my Jenny Laird Award for most puzzling creative choices, where are the women in the mutants?
Ding dong.
There are no female characters apart from Jo.
There are no female characters. I think there may be some background women, but
there are some black people and Chinese people and extras. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
doing the conferencey type thing. Yeah,
there's another guard apart from Cotton is black.
Yeah, So there is some effort in that
there's
story.
There's no women. Isn't that outrageous?
I think, as I say, there are some background Salonians, maybe with one or two lines, but no characters, if you like. There are female extras, but there are no female characters aside from Jo.
Oh, that's so boring.
And you know, any of the supporting characters could have been women. Yeah, it does
explain the flatness of it, doesn't it?
If they were worried about the implications of kinkiness, as they were with Colony in Space, you know, they could have made Sondergaard a woman.
The Marshal.
Well, that would have been kinky, you see. Remember, the head of Serials didn't like the idea of kinky women, which is any woman who is
in
not
power.
Virtuous.
really?
Yeah, well, pretty much. Awesome. Look at Susan Jameson's character.
That's why Morgan wasn't a woman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's my Jenny Laird for puzzling creative choice. Just
it's a good
you know,
one.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to see if Bob Baker and Dave Martin improve on that score. We shall see.
We don't know what's under Omega's frock. We've got no idea.
Picks of the month.
I had two, but I'm going to just have one. I'm going to save one for next month. And my pick of the week, I am contractually obliged to mention Philip Sander for every single podcast episode.
This is true.
And Stephen Wood.
Yes.
Oh, hello, yeah. Stephen Wood. Yes.
Yes. Oh, yes. We should definitely mention Stephen.
Well, we
do. But
especially in that three-quarter profile shot he's got on his page height.
So Sandifer has just wrapped up Tardis Eruditorum, which was his flight through entirety. He's been through Doctor Who, including some of the novels and stuff from the Wilderness years, and it's been really interesting. It's been really fun and insightful, and he's been doing the River Song stories out of order, you know, because the River Song stories are sort of out of order, you know, in the show, and so the final one that was left that was published just last month was The Forest of the Dead. It was the last one that he had to do. And instead of a review or an essay about Forest of the Dead, what he did instead was a 100,000-word blog post chronicling the entire history of Doctor Who, everything he's learned from the entire blog. Now, to give you an idea of how long 100,000 words is, Pride and Prejudice is 120,000 words. So it's a novel-length blog entry, and it is just one of the most concise and brilliant descriptions of the history of Doctor Who. Well, do you know what I mean? Compared to us. Compared to About Time, do you know what I mean? Compared to the blog itself, it's only
2,000 words a year of Doctor Who.
It's really, really good. It's really...
You read it?
Yes. Yeah.
And you have a job and everything.
It took me 2 days because I have a job and everything, but I did stay up really late, you know, one night to
get
it read.
Which was not reflected in your performance.
I was terrific at work the next day. I really recommend it. I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Thank you. I'm actually going to go and read that now. I shall go and read that now. Oh, well, I'm going to be really exciting and different and unusual again and say, go and read the Target novels, because I never say anything new. I really, really enjoyed Sea Devils. I even enjoyed Day of the Daleks, but Curse of Peladon by Mr. Hales is much better than the televised version. It actually carries it all through, and it's quicker. It's quicker to read it. No, it really is. Look, you get a different take on each one, but I won't say any more because we've gone on forever, almost 100,000 words. But really, I really like my pick for this season would be the Curse of Peladon novel, and I'm surprised to hear myself say it. So go have a quick little read. I'm sure you can find it somewhere.
My pick of the month is related to something I posted on our Facebook page a few weeks ago, which is real-time pictures have now been rebranded as Time Travel TV, and they're putting their back catalogue, particularly of Mythmakers interviews with Doctor Who stars and writers and directors and so on their website, available to buy as DVDs or download to own. As video on demand.
And treasure in your own video lounge.
That's right.
For eternity.
They actually have a 45-minute interview with Robert Sloman. Talking about his work on the Daemons, the Time Monsters, the Green Death, and Planet of the Spiders.
He was good.
He also talks about why he didn't return to Doctor Who after
Planet of
the Spiders. Because I don't think anyone would deny that probably the Green Death and Planet of the Spiders are the two best scripts he worked on.
I think Green
Death's
great.
They're all good.
Yeah,
no, they're not. The other three are rubbish.
They're all good.
But this was conducted 2 years before his death. He died in 2005. Mm. This was conducted in 2003.
Bugger, we could have had him writing for the new series.
So that's my recommendation. I mean, there's lots of lovely titles on there, but that one really caught my eye because his scripts are so polarizing, really.
Are they downloads? What are they?
So they're available as video on demand from Vimeo, the video sharing service, and each of the Mythmakers are available to download or stream to own. They're available for $9 US. They're also available to rent for half that price for a 48-hour period.
The price of a mid-range mocktail.
Yes, that's right.
In the comfort of the bar of your choice, or you can have, you can get really, really piss faced at home and watch them for the same price.
Take your iPad to the pub.
Yeah.
You can... no, because you get confused after a couple and use it as a coaster.
Yeah.
Haven't done that. Oh, yeah. It's a trouble.
Who hasn't done
that? I almost do it in 2001. You can see them.
People still use Christmas. Right, I think that's all the time we have today. We will be back in 2 weeks, although, Richard, you'll be taking some
I have to go to Cambridge again.
Again.
Yeah,
you have to go to Cambridge again. Perhaps
and
you'll get to see Liz.
Screaming.
No one else gets to see Liz. Yeah. Todd will be back with us as we make our way through Doctor Who's 10th anniversary season.
Oh, gosh, you're going to have a big time.
Yeah, the Three Doctors, Carnival of Monsters, Frontier in Space, Planet of the Daleks, and the Green Death, where... there's some really quite emotional times coming up in Doctor Who, and yeah, we find out that things are never stable for too long. So before we go, don't forget, if you come to us newly on the podcast, you can check out our website where you can easily find our past podcasts about the first two Doctors. We've even indexed them by story, so if you want to particularly hear what we said about the Space Pirates... or that
everybody is waiting to hear that. Yeah.
Or the Celestial Toymaker, because let's face it, sometimes you can't just run your fingers down a blackboard. You can listen to them there. You can also find us on Facebook, Flight Through Entirety, and on Twitter at FTE Podcast. If you've enjoyed listening to us, please drop us a line, send us a comment, review us on iTunes. We really like that. And until then, thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Frouncy Trouncy Bouncy Busty, was recorded on Sunday the 8th of March. The next episode will be released on April 12th. I tried to feed a rabbit to a boa constrictor once. It complained that there was a hair in its food.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottom... That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Katie's Bum, was recorded on March the...
It's not going to be called Katie's Bum.
No.
I think you should record it when we're not here.
I think you should do it when we're not here.